From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara brings charges against two former Cuomo administration officials and the head of SUNY Polytechnic. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the alleged pay-to-play charges and their impact, if any, on the governor. And we'll take you to Newburgh for a public meeting on water contamination. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Two Cuomo administration officials have been named in a criminal complaint by U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, accused of carrying out kickback and bribery schemes over a period of several years, many involving the governor's much-touted upstate economic development programs, including the Buffalo Billion. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The 80-page complaint names Joe Percoco, until recently a top aide to the governor, and the head of the State University of New York's Polytechnic Institute, Elaine Calieros, who's also the highest-paid official in the state. Percoco and his wife, who was hired as a no-show consultant to a Hudson Valley power plant project, illegally pocketed $322,000 over 4 years, says U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara.
We allege that Joseph Percoco, the former executive deputy secretary to the governor, and therefore one of the most powerful people in all of New York, was on the take.
Percoco was Andrew Cuomo's right-hand man. He was even referred to by the governor's father, the late former Governor Mario Cuomo, as his third son. Percoco was known in state government as Andrew Cuomo's enforcer. Most believe that when Percoco spoke, often admonishing those who disagreed with Cuomo, that he spoke for the governor. Calieros masterminded much of Cuomo's vast upstate economic development programs. Bharara alleges that Calieros, along with lobbyist Todd Howe, gamed the bidding system, in some cases even allowing key developers who made large campaign contributions to Cuomo to actually write the bids to tailor them to their own needs.
Elaine Calieros, the president of SUNY Polytechnic, and Todd Howe publicly made it appear as if these contracts were being awarded through a fair and open bidding process. But behind the scenes, they were cynically rigging the whole process so that the contracts would go to hand-picked friends of the administration, friends being a euphemism for large donors.
Todd Howe, the U.S. attorney alleges, made money on both sides, working both for the nonprofit associated with the state to facilitate the contracts and also accepting money from the developers. Bharara announced that Howe pleaded guilty to an 8-count indictment. He's now a cooperating witness in the case. Two major upstate developers have also been charged in the complaint, Syracuse-based Core Development and its officers, and Buffalo-based real estate developer Louis Simonelli. The complaint, in part, reads like an episode from The Sopranos. It alleges that Percoco actually took inspiration from the TV show about organized crime, choosing to use the word ziti as a code word when demanding bribe payments.
As in, and this is described in the complaint, quote, keep the ziti flowing, close quote, and, quote, don't tip over the ziti wagon.
Governor Cuomo issued a statement shortly after the complaint was made public, saying in part he is saddened and profoundly disappointed and that he has zero tolerance for abuse of the public trust, saying if anything, a friend should be held to an even higher standard. Cuomo has distanced himself from Percoco and Howe since the spring, when word of the federal probe got out. The governor spoke back on May 10th.
If anyone did anything wrong, I will be the first to throw the book at them.
Cuomo was not named in the complaint, but he's known to be a hands-on manager. Bharara was asked by a reporter whether, based on his investigation so far, he could give Cuomo a clean bill of health.
What I can say at this moment is that there are no allegations of any wrongdoing or misconduct by the governor anywhere in this complaint. That's all I'm going to say.
The criminal charges against Cuomo's associates and former top aide come as both former leaders of the state legislature face lengthy prison terms over federal corruption convictions. It also comes as State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is charging SUNY Poly's Calieros and another SUNY Poly board member with felony bid rigging in connection with several public development projects. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. We had been waiting to see what was going to happen with the investigations into New York Governor Andrew Cuomo administration's economic development programs, and Preet Bharara and the Attorney General of the state, Eric Schneiderman, in separate press conferences, came out with charges. In Schneiderman's case, as well as Preet Bharara, Elaine Calieros, the head of SUNY Polytechnic Institute, the major nanotechnology center in Albany, charged, as well as close aide to Governor Cuomo, Joe Percoco, and former aide Todd Howe in a basically pay-to-play scheme.
Well, David, there's a great deal of money, as you know, the Buffalo Billion, and all of the money was being spent on nanotech. And the governor, as of yet, has not been in any way seen as playing in this game. But it was once again the business of self-enrichment. Now, Todd Howe, the person who is very close to Cuomo, has pleaded guilty. And he, if there is a trial, is going to get on the stand and say, this is how the kickbacks occurred. So he's going to say what he knew. And that, of course, is going to bring in Percoco, who was known as the third brother in the Cuomo family. He was that close to everybody. And he'll either have to plead or he's going to go on trial. And I'm sure that's what these negotiations are all about. But, of course, Bharara was clearly waiting until he had his ships in order, and they're all lined up, and they're all doing what he needed to have done in order to bring these charges. He got up there. He made a fairly brief statement. We all thought it was going to be much longer. It was an 80-page document that brought these charges, and it looks like it's a very serious case.
Both Percoco and Calieros' lawyers have said they will be vindicated in the trial. And as you said, nonetheless, the governor was not implicated. But the statement was interesting from Bharara, Alan. There are no allegations of any wrongdoing or misconduct by the governor anywhere in this complaint. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, that's right. These were people around him. It's possible that he was betrayed. It is possible that he didn't know what was happening. We have to give him the benefit of the doubt. I've always thought that he's a very shrewd man. And I don't think that personal wealth is his issue. I think power is very important to him, and I think getting even with people is very important to him, as we have seen. Nevertheless, those are not criminal, unless, of course, your agents say to somebody, give money to a campaign, and we'll give you something back. But none of that seems to be the case here. So I'm simply saying that for now, Cuomo is in pretty good shape, except politically, he's not in great shape. You already see Assemblymen and others calling for his resignation. He was in charge of these guys while they were there, and it was his duty to make sure that they were behaving themselves. If they weren't, then, as with any elected administration, you hold somebody responsible. And usually, that's the person at the top. The big news, of course, was that a man who was too big to touch, Elaine Calieros, was also indicted, not only on federal charges, but on state charges by Attorney General Schneiderman. This, of course, came as a big bombshell, and he has been suspended by SUNY. And if this is the case, this is a real bombshell for an awful lot of people in the SUNY system who have thought that SUNY was being politicized to an unacceptable degree, as the governor used it again and again to help him with his economic plans.
Terrorism hits New York again, Alan. The top story in New York, of course, Ahmad Khan Rahami, a naturalized citizen of the United States from Afghanistan, who had, as we know now, traveled back and forth. And his own father had tipped off the FBI that he believed he was a jihadist. Nonetheless, bomb in Manhattan neighborhood of Chelsea, another one a few blocks away that did not detonate, and then police detonate a bomb in New Jersey. We are at this point looking at how our leaders have handled this week, and that became political. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, Mayor Bill de Blasio, not the best of friends, as you've talked about many times, and an argument over who did better.
Well, I was struck by an article, I believe in the New York Times, that complimented de Blasio, basically saying that he had conducted himself correctly, that he wasn't willing to say terrorism until terrorism was a case. Andrew Cuomo came racing out. We think that this may have been a manifestation of the competition between the two guys, and came racing out and said, it is terrorism. So it is an interesting next step in the competition between the mayor and the governor. Look, New Yorkers want to be safe. So the Donald Trumps and the other guys come out and they say, I'm going to make you safe. I'll stop and frisk. Well, stop and frisk in New York State is now goodbye. We don't do that anymore, allegedly. So let me just say that when you start appealing to people's fear, you may get votes from the people who see themselves as a potential victim. But you're also risking losing the votes of those people who understand exactly what it is to be targeted and picked on.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A public meeting this week concerning an update on the PFOS water contamination issue in Newburgh brought a formal announcement about the launch of a blood testing program for the city, but with it came more questions and concerns. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
Though the State Department of Health was in the spotlight and residents mainly wanted to know more about a PFOS biomonitoring program, the State Department of Environmental Conservation delivered a few updates of its own. Dan Shapley is Water Quality Program Manager for Riverkeeper. He was the only non-government member of the panel during the public meeting at Mount St. Mary College in Newburgh. Shapley says DEC officials mentioned a few developments that bode well for the environment.
You heard the DEC say that they're looking soon at some kind of treatment system for the water that's coming out of the Air Force Base that is contaminated. We've been calling for that. They are looking at fish testing soon, which is important. People get exposed by eating fish, and it's contaminating the environment. So those are two important things.
DEC Deputy Commissioner of Environmental Remediation and Materials Martin Brand said the fish sampling would begin this fall to assess any impacts from PFOS contamination. He said the sampling would occur in a few places, including Moodna Creek and Brown's Pond. As for treating water from outfalls from Stewart Air National Guard Base, a filtration plan is being discussed. The DEC in August declared the base a Superfund site after its investigation showed that outfalls from the base were a significant source of the PFOS contamination found in Washington Lake, the main drinking water source for the city of Newburgh. PFOS contamination was detected at levels as high as 5,900 parts per trillion at the outfalls that drain into Silver Stream and other tributaries to Washington Lake. Newburgh City Manager Michael Caravino has been concerned about the potential for Washington Lake to overflow, given it has not been used as a drinking water source since May, and hurricane season has arrived. He'd been calling on the DEC to take action. Caravino, speaking Monday, commended the DEC for stepping in to treat and draw down the water and prevent contamination elsewhere.
We're not going to pollute our neighbors the way we were polluted, and that's exciting. So that's the good news. What needs to happen next is where it's being discharged, at Rec Pond, at 5,900 parts per trillion. That should not come down Silver Stream untreated. So if you could visualize this, tomorrow morning we're going to have treated water, filtered water, coming out of Washington Lake, while if it's raining, we're still going to have untreated water coming right alongside it in the same Silver Stream untreated.
And he describes the setup to drain and treat water from Washington Lake.
And by the way, what they're doing is two hydraulically driven vertical turbine pumps on a raft right on Washington Lake. On Route 300, they've set up a temporary granular activated carbon treatment system. If you go there now or tomorrow morning, you'll see 10 silos about 15, 20 feet tall that they've loaded the carbon into. And then what they've set up is a long 12-inch diameter temporary piping parallel to Route 300 that goes all the way down to Silver Stream, where it's then going to be discharged once it's been filtered.
The DEC's brand in August informed Caravino that it had directed a state contractor to implement a plan to lower the water levels in Washington Lake. Orange County legislator Chris Ekus, who represents the town of New Windsor, also wants to see water from the outfalls at the base treated.
Let's stop the poisoning now. Cut off the water from Silver Stream. Stop it now.
Ekus, a Democrat, is running against longtime Republican State Senator Bill Larkin. Newburgh now draws water from the Catskill Aqueduct, for which the state is picking up the tab. The DEC will fund the installation of a permanent carbon filtration system, expected to be up and running by October 2017. Preliminary data suggests the contamination is the result of the historic use of firefighting foam at Stewart Air National Guard Base.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Earlier this year, New York State finalized the purchase of the 20,758-acre Boreas Ponds Tract in the Adirondacks, completing a 69,000-acre acquisition of former Finch Prime lands from the Nature Conservancy. The Department of Environmental Conservation has issued an interim access plan, but as the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports, environmental groups are concerned that the plan could compromise eventual classifications of the land.
The interim access plan for the Boreas Ponds Tract allows just over 3 miles of motor vehicle access on the Gulf Brook Road, opens over 6 miles of roads to bicycling from Blue Ridge Road to the Boreas Ponds Dam, and allows horse and horse-drawn wagons on about 25 miles of 7 roadways. Paddlers will have access to Boreas Pond and other waterways if they carry in their canoes. All of the lands are open to camping if the campsites are more than 150 feet away from any roadway or body of water. The plan also outlines public parking areas. Adirondack Wild Friends of the Forest Preserve managing partner David Gibson has written to DEC Commissioner Basil Sagos expressing concerns about the interim plan. Gibson says the agency should not be setting a pattern for use before the land is classified.
It's part of our forest preserve, but it's not yet classified in terms of the state land classification process outlined in the state land master plan. The commissioner of DEC has said this will be a conservative plan that does not foreclose any options for future classification. But when you read the plan, you find out that there is no natural resource analysis at all to guide this interim period of maybe many months before there's a classification. And the state land master plan says that natural resource management should come first, and recreational use, while important, should come as a second priority. This interim plan places recreation as the first priority and establishes a pattern of use that is difficult to pull back from.
Adirondack Wild is a member of Be Wild, a coalition of environmental groups that wants the tract classified wilderness. The Adirondack Council, another member of Be Wild, agrees with Gibson's concerns over the interim plan. Executive Director Willie Janeway notes that their fundamental concern is that the interim plan does not prejudice the ultimate classification of the tract.
I have not seen significant daylight between the Adirondack Wild and the Adirondack Council concerns with regard to the interim plan for Boreas, that the plan should in no way prejudice or bias future management decisions, that there should be transparency with regards to the science that underpins the decisions they made, and people should have an opportunity to comment on that, that there's mountain biking the last mile right to the edge of Boreas Ponds versus stopping it a mile further back. We're concerned about that, some of the horse use. But the bigger focus really is on the classification decision that is pending.
The towns surrounding the former Finch Prime lands have joined together as the Upper Hudson Recreation Hub to more effectively argue their concerns. Ron Moore is supervisor of the town of North Hudson, which abuts the Boreas Ponds tract. He notes that the towns have already crafted a plan for a final classification that would allow for wild forest in the southern section of the tract and wilderness elsewhere. Moore says the interim plan does not compromise its potential classification.
The whole purpose, as the governor has stated, and the DEC commissioners, both Joe Martens and Basil Sagos, have supported increased tourism through the purchase of these lands and increased recreational opportunities that would result in increased economic benefit. And we feel that this plan supports that mission, maintains a balanced approach. This is all wilderness, essentially. That's going to eliminate the possibility of 90% of the people, probably, that would ever access this property.
Links to more information are at WAMC.org. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The Occupy movement began 5 years ago as Occupy Wall Street when activists flooded a park in New York City with demands for economic equality. The movement takes credit for introducing income inequality into the broader political discourse, for inspiring the fight for a $15 minimum wage, and even the Democratic presidential campaign of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The local anti-establishment crusade against the power of elites, the so-called 1%, was known as Occupy Albany. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas has a closer look at the movement.
The original Occupy Albany encampment was one of 2,000 across the globe inspired by the sit-in in New York's Zuccotti Park. It sprung up in Lafayette Park across from the state capitol building in October 2011. More than 100 protesters, ranging from high school students to senior citizens, demonstrated in a show of solidarity bent on curbing corporate greed and the influence of Wall Street. Media immediately began to identify local voices of the national movement. UAlbany activist Sharman Hussein said then that Occupy had special meaning for all college students.
The education system is deteriorating because it's getting privatized, our tuition is getting hiked, as well as all our resources are being cut. We're asked to pay more for less.
Fast forward 5 years. Did Occupy Albany make a difference? Kathy Manley was another familiar face and voice during Occupy Albany.
Since Occupy, there's a great deal of understanding about the income inequality that we have in this country and how it's been increasing and increasing and how people are having a harder and harder time.
State Assemblywoman Pat Fahey agrees with that assessment and adds,
the economic divide in the country has grown tremendously. The wage gaps, the low income wages have not kept pace, especially in the last 40 years, whereas those at the highest level, the one percenters that, again, the Occupy movement put on the map, that 1%, those incomes have grown dramatically in the last 40 years, even in the last 10 to 20 years. So I think it began the seeds of education. So in that regard, I give it tremendous credit.
Albany City Treasurer Darius Shahanfar believes Occupy successfully brought the important economic issues of everyday people to the forefront.
I think it really has changed the psychology of people, both in the capital region and nationwide, about what we expect from our government. And I think it really manifested itself in the Bernie Sanders campaign this year, that's for sure.
It's also for sure that Occupy Albany became a thorn in the side of state and local government. On December 22, 2011, as the cold and snow closed in, Occupy Albany ignored an order from the city to vacate the park. Then, on Christmas Eve, police moved in to end the occupation, arriving in the afternoon on the day of the deadline, as they had promised. In some other cities, lawmen came without warning in dead of night. By early evening, all the Occupy Albany tents were gone, save one taken intact by the protesters who paraded it through the city. That led to a protracted legal standoff. Eventually, charges against the protesters were not pursued by the district attorney. Again, Kathy Manley.
I don't know if I could point to particular victories that come directly from Occupy, but there's many, many people who were involved in Occupy who've been active since then in many causes and campaigns, like increasing the minimum wage, Black Lives Matter, and generally criminal justice reform, and a lot of environmental issues too, opposing global warming, protesting the oil trains.
In early 2012, Occupy Albany moved indoors, opened a storefront headquarters in the city, and to this day maintains a presence on Facebook, where, although apparently dormant, it waits for a new chance to mobilize the masses, perhaps. Dave Lucas, WAMC News.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1639 or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.